Beginning here on the top of, you'd bet, I'm with Aleph by the two dots. It says, Nigmar Dino. Amir Yehuda Amarav, Shteta Yot Ta Yoav Boto Shah. Yoav made two mistakes at that time, or at that moment. Dichtiv, Vayanas Yoav El Ol Hashem, Vayechazak Bekarnol Tamizbeach. Yoav ran to the Ol Hashem and grabs onto the Karnol Tamizbeach. This is at the end of Yoav's life, because David HaMelech had instructed Shlomo not to let Yoav go to his grave in the natural manner, because of what he had done during the time period of David, where he killed two Tzarei Tzava of Israel, Abner Bener, and Amasa, during the time period of David. And so Shlomo HaMelech is instructed basically to take care of Yoav. Yoav joins the anointing of Adoniyahu HaMelech, which starts to break apart once David informs the people that Shlomo HaMelech is going to be the king, and Natan HaNavi and Tzadok HaKohen are with Shlomo HaMelech. So Yoav realizes that now he's really in big trouble, because not only did David instruct Shlomo to make sure that he didn't make it through his full life, but also now he had joined Adoniyahu, and Shlomo HaMelech is going to consider that to be a rebellion or treason against him. So he knows he's got his end. So he runs to the Mizbeach and grabs onto the Mizbeach. This is what we spoke about the other day, which was found in many other religions, still found in some religions, and in Hammurabi's code and other places, that the temple, and as the word is, sanctuary, were places where you could seek refuge in sanctuary and were protected from the law. I mean, people would not step in there, whether it was an army, whether it was a judiciary, they would not step past the bounds of the temple or the sanctuary. And that means no matter what the sin was that was done, the person could run there and seek sanctuary. Now, they couldn't leave. If they ever left, then they were in trouble because anybody could take them out, but you'd have to remain the rest of their life in that area of sanctuary. The Chiddush of the Torah is the Pasuk in Mishpatim, which says, Mi'im Mizbechi Tikachenu Lamut, that it doesn't matter. If you are going to the Mizbeach, we're going to take you off the Mizbeach and kill you. There is no such sanctuary for individuals who have sinned. If you've done something wrong, God's not going to provide you sanctuary. Or in the words of the Nevi'im, like in the first parak in Yeshayahu, and throughout Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and many other of the Nevi'im, that you can't violate things in Ben Adam L'chaveiro, and then come to Ben Adam Makom, come to Hakadosh Baruch Hu to save you. If you kill someone, you're responsible for killing that person. The Mishkan, the Mikdash, is not going to provide you sanctuary for what you have done. So over here, Yoav does exactly that. He runs to the sanctuary, he runs to the Mizbeach, in order to seek refuge from Shlomo HaMelech. Ta'a, she'enu kolet el gago. So his first mistake is that the Mizbeach only helps when you're on top of the Mizbeach. Behu tafas v'kanotav. Not when you're holding on to the corners of the Mizbeach. That there, midayek, out of the pasuk, which is, mi'im mizbechi tikachenu lemut. So it's mi'im mizbechi, below mi'al mizbechi. So you can't take it if he's on top of the mizbeach. That would actually undermine somewhat of what I just said, but we'll see in a second. Ta'a, she'enu koleit ela mizbeach beit olami. He made a mistake that only the beit ha-mikdash, the mizbeach there, provides that sanctuary. Hutafas mizbeach shel Shiloh. That girs is obviously incorrect, because Shiloh was destroyed back at the time of Eliyah Kohen. So he can't be speaking about the Mizbeach Shel Shiloh. And the only other possibility is that it's the Mizbeach of Shiloh which was moved. David HaMelech had moved the Aron up to Yerushalayim. That went through, we know, a number of locations or steps until it got there, where it was taken by the Plishtim, then ended up in Beit Shemesh, Kiryat Yarim, and then one other stop, and then up to Yerushalayim. That's where the Aron is. But we know from the beginning of Melachim that Shlomo HaMelech brings the Mizbeach of Shiloh into the Beit HaMikdash, but he's bringing that from Givon. It had moved to Nov Ir HaKohanim, but that was destroyed by Shaul. And after that, it moved over to Givon. So even though David puts up a tent in Yerushalayim with the Aron, the Mizbeach of Shiloh remains in Givon. David HaMelech also put a Bama inside of that Ohel in Yerushalayim. So the Mizbeach that you're speaking about is one of those two Mizbechot. It's either the Mizbeach in Yerushalayim, that is, by the Aron, the Bama that David HaMelech had put there, or it's the Bama Gdola that is found in Givon, which is the Mizbeach of Shiloh. So if you keep the Girsa of Mizbeach Shel Shiloh, then you would have to say it was in Givon. Rashi changes the Girsa to say, B'Mizbeach Shel Bama. Then on the Mizbeach of the Bama, which would be the Bama of David that was in the Ohel in Yerushalayim, which would make more sense because that's where they were. They had just anointed Adonai down by the Silwan, and so he would have been close to Yerushalayim. It's unlikely that he ran all the way to Gibeon in order to hang on to the Mizbeach. So Abaye Omer, Baha Nami Mitata, he also made this mistake. It's a third mistake. Ta Shenu Kolet Elokoin Babu Dabi Ado Behuzaraya. The other mistake was that it only takes in a Kohen who's in the middle of Avodah. It does not protect a Zar, does not protect a Kohen who's not doing Avodah. It doesn't protect a Kohen once he's done with the Avodah. So that, according to Abaye's statement over here, that would seriously limit the toilet of the Mizbeach in terms of a sanctuary. The way that it was said in the name of Rav, it seems that the Mizbeach does provide sanctuary, as long as you're on top of the Mizbeach, Al-Gaga Mizbeach, then you're fine. What he points out is that that's limited to Kohanim, and limited to Kohanim are doing Avodah. And that once again brings us back to what we said, that the Torah does not recognize sanctuary for people who kill or do the wrong thing, and you can't come to the temple, you can't come to where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is, and all of a sudden that provides you with sanctuary. Those are the mistakes he made. There's actually a fourth mistake that he made, which is based on the Gemara that's coming up, we're going to see in a second, is that it only provides sanctuary, Bishogeg, does not provide sanctuary, B'mezid. That's true of the Ari Miklat, and seemingly it's true of the Mizbeach as well. Even if you say it provides sanctuary, it should only be for someone who is Horeg Bishogeg, and not Horeg B'mezid. Rishonim answer on behalf of Yoav, or why that wasn't the problem, is because, based on the Gemara we saw in Sanhedrin, Yoav felt that he was justified in killing both Avner Ben-Er, because he was the Goel Adam for his brother Asael, who had been killed by Avner Ben-Er. And he felt justified in killing Amasa, because he was Morid B'Malchut. He had joined the rebellion of Absalom. It's for that reason Yoav believed that he was deserving of sanctuary here as a Shogeg. And you'd have to give a broader definition of Shogeg here, not to mean that it was unintentional. Of course it was intentional. It just means that he wasn't a Mezid. Mezid in the sense that he could be put to death for what he did. He could justify why he did it, and therefore he would not be subject to the death penalty. So he felt that it would have helped him by Shogeg. That's one way to deal with it. The other possibility is based on the Rabbeinu Chananu here quotes the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi it says, Rabbi Yochanan, Shalach, Rabbi Yochanan who's in Eretz Yisrael, sends to Bavel, I heard two things over in the name of Rav, and I disagree with both of them. So one of them has to do with Yifat Toar, which is not our sugya here. The other one is about this story here with the Mizbeach. And he says that Rav said that Yoav made two mistakes, but implied in Rav's statement is that the Mizbeach does provide sanctuary. To that, Rabbi Yochanan says, Vani Omer, lo akarnot koltot, velo agad kolet. Says, not the top of the Mizbeach, not the corners of the Mizbeach, lo shel Shiloh, velo shel Beit Olamim, doesn't matter whether it's in Shiloh or the Beit HaMikdash, ve'enan koltot, Ella Ayirei Miklat Bilvad. The only place to go is the near Miklat. The Mizbeach serves no purpose in terms of Klita for people who kill. So there's no such thing as a Mizbeach Kolet. That's very interesting. Rabbi Yochanan clearly takes what we were discussing before, the Ruach, or the spirit of the law here, is that the Mikdash is not a place of sanctuary if you kill. That's just not where you go. You want to go to near Miklat, if you're Bishogeg, that's fine. You're Mezid, you have no sanctuary, and it's not going to be provided by the Mizbeach. But then he goes on to say, Ve'efshar, Yoav, who was so smart and knew all these dinin, made such a mistake? That's what Rabbi Yochanan says. Ella, and this is the explanation of Rabbi Yochanan, which is interesting only because the Rambam codifies this halacha, and he brings Rabbi Yochanan, the halacha being the following. Ella le Sanhedrin barach. He ran to the Sanhedrin, Amar Mutav, Yahareg beBeit Din. I'm better off being killed by Beit Din. Sheyir Shuhu Banav, because then my children will inherit me. But if I'm executed by the king, Haruge Machut, Nixayim LeMelech. If you're executed for a violation of treason or any act against the king, when you're killed, your property goes to the king. We have examples of that throughout Tanakh. Just quickly, ones that you're very familiar with are Achav with Navot. After he kills Navot, he takes the kerem of Navot because he was executed for treason because he had cursed the king, and therefore he was entitled to take the property. And that's what Izebel sets up so that Achav can get the property of Navot. Also in Megillat Esther, all the property went to Achashverosh And then it's given to Esther and Mordecai. All of Haman's property is given over to them. Why did the king get Haman's property? Because he was deemed to be a Moreid b'malchut. And any Moreid b'malchut, the property goes to the king. So Yoav's fear was that if he was executed as a treasonous individual, he would lose all of his Yerusha, and it would go to the king. So he runs to the Mizbeach, but not literally the Mizbeach, he goes to the Mizbeach to go to get the Sanhedrin to protect him and intervene on his behalf. And Shlomo Melech, according to the Yushami, responds, V'chile b'mano ad nitzarich, I don't care about his property. So Asir d'mei chinam ad nitzarich, I have to do what my father instructed me, which is to take revenge on Yoav for spilling innocent blood in times of peace. And so he goes ahead and tells the general to go back and kill Yoav while he's still on the Mizbech. That's where he wants to die. That's where he wants to be. Then you're going to take him and kill him right there. And he'll get his wish to be killed. He's not leaving the Mizbech. The Rambam for this codifies in Hilchot Rotzeach Perkei that if a person is being chased by Beit Din or by the king, they can seek sanctuary by the Mizbech. As opposed to seeking sanctuary when one kills and is running away from the Gol Adam. In those senses, the Rambam says no sanctuary, just like we see over here, maybe with the exception of Kohen Be'avodah. In providing sanctuary, he does mention that we don't leave him by the Mizbeach. If a person seeks sanctuary over there, we move them to the Ir Miklat. But if it comes to running away from the king, or running away from Beit Din, and Beit Din wants to kill him, Behorat Sha'ah, the Mizbeach does provide sanctuary. This whole idea that you can be saved from the king or from the Beit Din is interesting because it's not mentioned in the Bavli at all. It comes from this Rabbi Yochanan in the Yerushalmi. And seemingly the Rambam is paskening based on this Rabbi Yochanan in the Yerushalmi. And there he says that the person can be taken off if they are Chayav Mitah with the Edim. That has to be a justified execution of the individual. It can't simply be that the king wants him out of the way. And then he seeks sanctuary there, then we're not going to come and intervene to give him back to the king or to allow the Beit Din to intervene. It has to be that he really is deserving of death. Anyway, that's just as an aside, because the Rambam paskens like that, so it's interesting to see what the Yerushalmi says. Now the Gemara continues and says, Amar Reish Lakish, Shalosh Tayot Atid Saroh Shel Romi Lit'ot. And in the future, the Saroh Shel Rom will make these mistakes. Dichtiv. Because the Pasuk says, now Rashi notes over here, this is in the context of understanding that when a Kadosh Baruch Hu takes revenge or takes out his anger on a nation, he first takes out its Sarim, and then afterwards he takes out the people, which is Yifkod Hashem al Tzva HaMarom b'Marom, and Hashem takes out all those that are up above, above, and then V'achar Kach HaMalchei Adama al Adama, and then afterwards on the people below. So the idea being that as long as there is a ministering angel above protecting them below, then those that are below will not be killed, will not be conquered, will not be subject to subjugation. But once you take the sar of that nation above and you subjugate them in a way that automatically means whatever happened above now will happen below. So we have many midrashim that describe when a Kadosh Baruch Hu gives over a ministering angel to someone and they can step on them or he holds them down and then that gives them the right to conquer that nation. And it has obviously metaphysical meaning over here as well as Kabbalistic meaning, which is that much of what happens down below is affected by what happens above. And so there are repercussions both from what we do down below because we send up Kedusha or we do things that pull the strings above. And the strings that are pulled above affect what happens down below. So that is being described over here according to Rashi. And that we have the Saroh Shel Esav, which Rashi calls Sama'el. Now Sama'el is also associated with the Yetzer Hara, or the evil inclination, or that which people do that is evil in life. And that will have impact on how you could explain this. Dichtiv, ki mize ba me'edom, chamutz bigadim mibatzra. Who is it that's coming from Edom with his soiled clothes? Mibatzra, from the place of Batzra. Now, we could be a chol, or speaking about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and as Rashi notes over here, chamutz bigadim means damo shel Sama'el. The blood of Sama'el is all over the clothing of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's as if a Kadosh Baruch Hu had slain Sama'el, and then the blood splashed all over him, and he's coming from Batzra. Now the Gemara darshins. Toeh, she'eno koletet ela betzer, behu goleh le Batzra. He ran to Batzra to seek refuge, and he didn't know, or he made a mistake, that it's only Betzer Bamidbar that is in Ir Miklat, not Batzra. The question of where Batzra is, in the Pasuk, or the Pashtuta Pasuk, Batzra is in Edom. which is difficult because we don't know of any Arei Miklat that are in Edom. The Arei Miklat are found in Eretz Yisrael and maybe in Eber Yardin, the three that we know there. Nothing in Edom. So either you have to say that there's a different Batsra, which is in Eretz Yisrael, or you have to say that Batsra is in the future. When the expanded borders of Eretz Yisrael, then Batsra would also possibly have been a place that you might have thought that was a Arei Miklat. But he makes the mistake of it being going to Batsra instead of Betzer. Toeh, she'enu koleta de l'shogeg v'hu mezid. He also made the mistake that an Arei Miklat only happens when you do it unintentionally, not when you kill intentionally. This is the question we asked before. Why doesn't the Gemara bring that on Yoav as well? Hayat toeh, the third one is, she'enu koleta de l'adam. It only helps out a person, v'hu malachu, and he is an angel. And angels don't get helped by that sanctuary. The Maharal over here speaks about how this is homiletic in nature and explaining about the evil angels or the evil Sama'el that causes people to sin. And the question is that Sama'el then somehow gaining sanctuary, latid lavo, when of course Baruch Hu comes to be done the world and to look at all the situations about who did what he was supposed to do, who did not do what he was supposed to do. So this angel comes along and says, well, even though I was doing bad, I was only doing it the same Shemayim. I was doing it because people were not behaving. They were doing wrong, and therefore I was bringing about that evil side to them. And the question is there sanctuary for evil that Tid Lavo? That's how the Maharal looks at this. And the answer is no, that there is no sanctuary for evil that Tid Lavo. And even though, in a sense, he acted in the name of Hashem and doing it only because he wanted to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, nevertheless, in the end, doing something that is evil, doing something that is wrong, is problematic, and it doesn't gain you access to being favorably judged, even though you helped the Kodesh Baruch Hu with his Midat HaDin. And I think this also is somewhat reflected in when we say Atakadosh in the Tfilot of the Yomim Noraim, over there, when we say that the Chol Risha Kulak HaShan Techleh, that Latid Lavo, when the Kodesh Baruch Hu comes about, and there'll be the future, there'll be only a Malchut Hashem, then by definition, all evil will evaporate. It'll disappear because there'll be no room for it. There'll be nothing left of evil. And that's also borne out, according to Maharal, with this as well. So, Amar Yibo, Arei Miklat, lo nitnu l'gvura. Arei Miklat cannot be used for burial. Tichtiv, umigrishehem, yulabem tam, ulerechusham, ulechol chayatam. This is speaking about the Arei Alevim. And it says that the areas around the Arei Alevim will be for grazing your animals, for your possessions, and anything that you need for your livelihood. They were given for living, not for the dead, or not for kvura. So the Gemara here does something in the next couple of memrot, which is a little difficult, but obviously has implications. What they are saying over here is, we're questioning something from the Arei Alevim, and then the Gemara says, well, how could you say that? The Arei Miklat don't have that. So the easy answer to all these questions would be simply to say, that's true of the Arei Alevim, it's not true of the Arei Miklat. And we saw already earlier in the Perek that there are distinctions or differences in the Dinim between Arei Miklat and the Arei Alevim. We saw that Arei Alevim are Kolet, only Midat, whereas the Arei Miklat are Kolet, Midat, and Shalom Midat. So you could have done the same thing in all of these situations, you could have given the same answer. The Gemara does not give that answer. It conflates the Arei Alevim and the Arei Miklat. So that shows you two things. First of all, that the Gemara doesn't see that distinction over here. Number two is that the Arei Miklat also served as Arei Alevim or Arei Kehuna. So it wasn't just the 42 Arei Alevim. The 6 Arei Miklat were also part of the Arei Alevim. So that's why they would have a din like an Ir Levi. And vice versa, the Arei Alevim were also functioning as Arei Miklat. So for that reason, the Gemara questions. Again, in Pashtut, you could have just answered, there's a difference between an Arei Miklat and an Arei Levi. We just saw yesterday in the Mishnah, Shama, Shamtehi Dirato, Shamtehi Mitato, Shamtehi Kvurato, that when the person has to run to the Arei Miklat, he remains there forever. He lives there, he dies there, he's buried there. So what are you saying to me? You can't have Kvura. Here we say we have a specific limud, Mishnah brought that you can be buried in the Arei Miklat, or must be buried in the Arei Miklat. Rotzeach Shaini, the Gali Bei Rachmano. Rotzeach is different because the Torah explicitly permitted it to be done. For two reasons here, it makes a difference. One part of the answer is that, simply, Rotzeach has permission to be buried there. The Levi'im that live there don't have permission to be buried there. So you can use it v'kvura for Rotzeach. You cannot use it v'kvura for the Levi'im. So that's one distinction. That distinction might be precipitated by the difference in the burial. The Rotzeach was buried there. We said that when the Kohen Gadol dies, they exhume the body and they take it back to Kivrei Avotav. So he's only buried there temporarily. Whereas if it was a Ben Levi who lived there, if you were to bury them there, they would stay. That is their living place. That's their living space. That's where they dwelt. So for that reason, you would also then not allow for Levi'im to be buried, because Levi'im would be permanent burial, whereas Rotzeach is only temporary burial. So the difference is both borne out by the Gezerat HaKatuv that tells us that you must bury the person who ran to the Ir Miklat there until the Kohen Gadol dies. But also you could explain through that why that might be permitted, because of the temporary nature of the burial for Rotzeach versus that of a Ben Levi. Now, Kashem She'ir Koletet, just like the ear is kolet, so is Tchuma. Very meaning. And this is what I was saying too. Now they're going to bring another proof from Erei Levim and ask a question. Vayeshev ba, he has to dwell there, ba velo b'tchuma. And you can dwell in the Ir Miklat, but you may not dwell in the Tchum. Bablo B'Tchuma. It sounds like the city itself provides you protection, but not the Tchum of the city. Not the district of the city limits, the periphery of the city will not provide you that protection against what our Mishnah says, which is the Tchum of the city does provide that protection. Rabbi Lokasha, that's not a problem. Kan leklot, kan ledur. Depends if you want protection or you want to live there. It provides protection, meaning that if you're in that area, the Gol Adam cannot attack you. On the other hand, you may not live in that area. You can live in the city, you can't live in the Tchum. So the Gemara says, Lador, Tibuglei, Denosim Sadeh Migrash, Lo Migrash Sadeh, Lo Migrash Ir, Lo Ir Migrash. Why don't you learn that out from the Dinim by the Arei HaLevi'im? So again, here you see this issue of raising an issue that is particular to an Ir Levi and saying it applies to an Ir Miklat. So again, the easy answer would have been to say that it's an Ir Miklat versus Arei HaLevi'im, and that's why you need it. Once again, the Gemara does not go that route, and instead says there's got to be something that differentiates here about the Ir Miklat from the Ir Levi that is necessary to say it. And that is that we have a din by the Arei HaLevi'im. It says there that you have to leave 2,000 amot outside the city, and then another pasuk says you have to leave 1,000 amot. So the way that the Gemara reconciles it is to say that you only need to leave 2,000 amot, but 1,000 of those amot have to be empty space, and 1,000 of those amot have to be fields. So if you have a city over the Ir HaLevi'im, around the city you have 1,000 amot buffer around the city, which is trees, parks, empty space, and then beyond that you have another 1,000 amot, which are the fields, the produce of the city is grown over there. So now what the Gemara is asking is, in the Arei HaLevi'im, you have a requirement to leave that buffer outside the city, and you're not allowed to change it. You're not allowed to make the migrash, the empty space, into a sadeh. You can't make the sadeh into empty space. You can't make the empty space into a city. You can't make the city into migrash. They all have particular purposes, and you can't switch between them. So now you would know that if a person's not allowed to live in the tchum of the city, because that is a migrash, and you're not allowed to make a migrash into a residential area, to make it into a place where people dwell. And for that reason alone, he shouldn't be allowed to live in the tchum. Why do you need a separate pasuk by the Arei Miklat? So Amar Rav Sheshet, lo nitzrocha l'michilot. That's because you could accomplish dwelling there without undermining what is said about the Arei Levi'im. If you're above ground, then you're right. If you dwell in that area, you're changing a migrash, the empty area, into a residential area, which is not permitted. The other hand, if you have tunnels or caves that are underneath that area of the migrash, a person can take up residence underground and not affect the utility of that which is above. It can remain an empty area, it can remain a migrash, and despite that fact, you could be living below. So the pasuk by the Arei Miklat comes to tell you, not only can you not live above because it's an Ir Levi, you also can't live below ground because it's ba, below b'tchuma. You have to live in the city, and you can't live in the tchum of the city. Rotzeach, Rotzeach that leaves the boundaries of the Ir Miklat, then he is subject to the Goel Adam killing him. Tarabanan, Veratzach Goel Adam et Rotzeach. Pasuk tells us that Vim Yatzo Yetzei Rotzeach et Gvul Ir Miklato Esher Yenushama. If he wanders out beyond the borders of the Ir Miklat, Umatzah Oto Goel Adam Mechutz Le Gvul Ir Miklato. And sure enough, the Goel Adam finds him outside the area of the city. Veratzach gvel adam et rotzeach in ludam. The gvel adam may kill the rotzeach, the one who had killed the one bishugeg who's there. In ludam, once again, you have a dangling modifier. In the pasuk, it's not clear who the lo references to. In ludam could refer to the gvel adam. This is right, when the gvel adam kills the rotzeach, the one who's rotzeach bishugeg, in ludam, he has no responsibility for that because he's permitted. Or it could be that in ludam is a reference to the rotzeach. So the gvel adam can kill the rotzeach in ludam because he has no blood. That will have implications according to, here we're going to see our machloket tanaim, as to who is permitted to kill the person who leaves the ir miklat. Is it because the gvel adam has a free pass, or is it because the rotzeach is considered to be free game, and that anybody can kill him because ain't no dam. He's not considered to be someone that you would be punished for. You see here, this is what machloket tanaim is about. Tanarabanan, ratzach gvel adam et rotzeach. Mitzvah biyad gvel adam. It is a mitzvah. The Torah is telling you that you should do this, meaning that the gvel adam should kill the individual if they leave the ir miklat. Ein lo gvel adam. If there is no gvel adam, reshut biyad gvel adam, then anyone else has permission to do it, but there's no imperative. Divrei Rabbi Yossi HaGlili. So he says that the gvel adam has a mitzvah to kill the individual when they leave the ir miklat. Anybody else who is filling in for the gvel adam, that means that there is no gvel adam. There's no relative there. Ein lo gvel adam means that there's nobody who can do it, or nobody who's present there. Then other people can take up the slack of the gvel adam, but there it's only a reshut. It's optional. There's no imperative to do such. If you do it, then obviously you would not be tried for it. You would not be brought up on charges. Rabbi Kiva Omer, reshut biyad gvel adam, that the gvel adam is optional. The gvel adam has no mitzvah to kill this individual. And simply, if he chooses to, it is fine. Bechol adam, and over here, once again, we have the girsa issue that we saw in our Mishnah yesterday, which is the girsa we have in front of us, is bechol adam chayavin alav, that anybody who would do this would be held accountable or responsible, meaning that it would be considered murder if anybody besides the gvel adam killed this person when he leaves the ir miklat. The girsa that is favored by the Rishonim is, b'chol adam ein chayavin alav. And any other individual, you would not be chayav for him. As to whether there's then any difference between Rabbi Yossi HaGlili and Rabbi Akiva in their second statement is actually interesting, because the Gemara now is going to discuss the machloket between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, and it only brings reasons for their first statement, which is, what is the status of the gvel adam? Is it a mitzvah or is it reshut? They never address the rights of other individuals here as to whether they have a reshut to do it or ein chayavin alav, which would imply that there is no difference between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi HaGlili in this second statement. They both believe that it is a reshut, and that's why the Gemara never asked what's the source, because they don't argue about that point. On the other hand, there are those like the Ritva that note that you could say that there is a nuanced difference over here, which is that Rabbi Yossi HaGlili says reshut. It's completely optional. And then Rabbi Akiva says, Chol adam ein chayavin alav. You're not going to be held accountable for it, but that doesn't mean it's mutar. It's patur aval asur. You will not be brought to trial for it, but it's asur for you to kill. On the other hand, if you say it's reshut, that makes it sound like it's completely optional. So he does see a difference in the position of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi HaGlili. It's nuanced, but it does make a difference, even though the Gemara never addresses that difference. My time at the Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, what's the reason behind Rabbi Yossi HaGlili's position? Miktiv imratzach doesn't say if he kills. The verb is said in the active form, which is veratzach goel adam, the rotzeach, that the goel adam kills the rotzeach. Rabbi Kiva miktiv yirtzach. It doesn't say it in the imperative form. It only says it as veratzach. So let's go through this and just understand that there is agreement over here with regards to if you have some introductory phrase like im, if, that clearly makes it that there's no imperative and it is optional. The fact that you use the word im is implying that it's if this happens or if you so choose to do. So that im is known as reshut, even though we do have exceptions of that in the Torah and Kesef Talveh Tami. Also there, we don't see it as being optional, we see that as being an imperative. But in general, if you have the word im as an introductory statement, that is considered to be reshut or optional, and Rabbi Akiva would agree with that. Everybody agrees that if the command is written in a future tense, which is yirtzach, you shall kill, so then everybody agrees that that is a tzivoy and that is a mitzvah. And that's the way the Torah presents mitzvah throughout the Torah, is that when it gives a command, it gives a command in the future tense, and that is for sure a tzivui. The problem arises with the term viratzach, and that is because the term ratzach, as Rashi notes over here, has two ways to be explained. Igale frushe lashon tzivui. Sometimes that is lashon tzivui. Kamo vasab mitzalel v'oliyav. When it comes to the Mishkan, Hashem says v'asah, they won't make. He's not giving them the option to make it. He's telling them to make it. It's a tzivui. On the other hand, igale frushe lashon reshut. You can't explain it as lashon reshut. Kamo vasah Hashem lahem, that Hashem will do to them. And over there again, it's not that it must happen. It will happen if this is what Hashem chooses to do. So now, you can see that the verb, both can be used to mean tzivui and to mean lashon reshut. And that's what Rabbi Yosef Glean and Rabbi Kiva are arguing about. The word v'ratzach over here is that lashon of tzivui. That's what Rabbi Yosef Glean says, because that's the majority of the way that it's used in the Torah, is to be a tzivui. And therefore he sees it as tzivui. Rabbi Kiva, on the other hand, sees it as a reshut. He says you can't go after the rogue in these types of situations to kill someone, and if there's a possibility of explaining it as a reshut, you can't give someone permission to go kill another person based on that. In addition, Rabbi Akiva's position probably is premised in the fact that it says, v'ratzach, if he did kill, which is lashon b'diavad. It's not lashon lechatchila. It's not telling you, you should kill. It says, if you did kill, then this is the din, which is always a lashon of b'diavad. And that's why Rabbi Kiva feels that it's a reshut and not a mitzvah. So that would be the explanation of their machloket. Amar marzutra batubi amar Rav. So now we have a statement from Rav, which is shocking, which is, Rotzeach, sheyatzach chutz l'tchum, umitzao goel adam. If a Rotzeach leaves his city of sanctuary, city of refuge, and he's met by the goel adam, v'harago, and the goel adam kills him, neherag alav. The goel adam will be brought to trial for murder, and he could be rendered guilty and put to death for the fact that he killed this individual. Come on, who is that position like? Loka Rabbi Yosef Glili, the Loka Rabbi Akiva. It's like neither of the two Tanaim that we saw. Rabbi Yosef Glili says it's a mitzvah. Rabbi Akiva at least says it's optional. He doesn't say that you can be brought up on murder charges. Here, Rav and Amora is suddenly saying that he can be brought up on murder charges to Gol Adam. So, Huda Marki Aitana. Rav subscribes to this Tana's position. Tatani Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Adam do lifnei aida de mishpat, until he stands before the aida to be judged. Mata malomar says ve'yul lachem harim lemiklat migoel v'lo yamut arutzeach. Adam do lifnei aida de mishpat, that he will not be allowed to be killed by the goel adam. It seems Adam do lifnei aida de mishpat, until he's brought before the aida to be adjudicated. So Rabbi Elazar says from this, and this is the source for Rab's position, which is, Matom Lomar, what does the puzzle tell you? The Vishon Amar, V'ratzach Goel Adam et Arutzeach, the puzzle that we've been quoting until now, that the Goel Adam has a right to kill him, Yoko Miyad, you would have thought that was immediately true. Tamar Lomar, Adam Dol Lifnei Aida L'Mishpat, until he's brought to trial, he may not be killed. Now, over here, the Gemara doesn't give you any indication of what it means. Rashi doesn't even comment on this. And it's unclear what that means or what the implications of Rav's statement are based on Rabbi Eliezer's position, which is that you go Adam doesn't have a right to kill him, Adam dole mishpat, until he comes to be judged by the court. The simple way to read it, possibly, is just to say that the go Adam doesn't have a right to kill the Rotzeach unless he killed B'mezid. So that he has to Adam dole mishpat. You bring him to court. And once the court decides that he is guilty as a Rotzeach b'mezid, then the Torah tells you later on that the yad of the Goel Adam, yamit et Rotzeach b'figo bo yamitenu, then that he's put to death. If he kills b'mezid, the Goel Adam is the one of the parties like the Edim that puts this person to death and kills him. So maybe that's the view of Rav and Rabbi Eliezer over here, which is that the right of the Goel Adam to kill is only when the person killed B'mezid. That's one way to read it. The other possible way to read it is that only once you've been brought to trial do you have a right then of the Goel Adam to kill him. The Goel Adam doesn't have a right to kill him until the trial is done. It means that when he runs to the Ir Miklat in the first place, the Goel Adam doesn't have a right then. Why is he running to the Ir Miklat? If the Goel Adam can't kill him, it's not so clear. But according to that, he would only be allowed to enter the fray after he went to the Ir Miklat. Then, once the Beit Din determines that he is a Tzeach Mishugeg, then is returning to the Ir Miklat, then he might be exposed to possible killing by the Goel Adam. The way the Rabbeinu Chananel says, Shum Rav Amru Rotzeach Sheyatzach Chutz L'Tchum, Kodem Shigmar Dino L'Galut. If he leaves here Miklat before he has a Gmar Din L'Galut, Umetzao Gol Adam, Habargo Neragalav, then he'd be killed. Meaning that as soon as the trial is over, according to the Rabbeinu Chananel, then you have a right to kill him. But until the trial, you have no right to kill him. But then there's still a possibility of killing him after the trial. The Rambam said before, when we send the two Talmidei Chachamim with him, that was when he's being returned to the Beit Mikdash, and then the Goldam could kill him. And we have the Talmidei Chachamim there trying to convince him not to kill him. It all depends on how you read that part. Or do you say, like some of the Rishonim here, that he has a free pass to get back to the Eir Miklat, and then only then can the Goldam kill him. There are still others that suggest what he's saying is, Adam Dol Mishpat means after the Beit Din returns him to the Eir Miklat. Because it says that he goes to the Eir Miklat, Beit Din takes him from there, and then they return him there. Only once he is returned to the Miklat does the Gol Adam have a right to kill him, if he goes Chutz L'Tchum. If he leaves the Tchum, and the most extreme version of this, the things brought by Ran, is that he is not subject to Mita until Beit Din convenes and warns him that he better not leave the Eir Miklat. If he left the Eir Miklat, then he's still not open to the Gol Adam until Beit Din comes and warns him. If you leave again, then you're going to be killed by the Gol Adam. And that's what it means, Amdol Mishpat. Amdol Mishpat means he's now brought to trial for violating the terms of his house arrest or city arrest, really, which is that he's now leaving the Eir Miklat. Until Beit Din declares him a violator, then they can't come and kill him, the Gol Adam. You have a spectrum here in the Rishonim from one end to the other end, because Gemara never really clarifies what Rabbi Eliezer's position is, but there's a possibility all the way from the fact that you could only kill him if he's a Rotzeach B'Mezid on one end, to the other end, which suggests that you could kill him after he comes to trial. And then in between, we had all those different shitot, which is, maybe only if he leaves the Eir Miklat, maybe only if he's warned when he leaves the Eir Miklat, all of those different possibilities, based on this statement of Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Kiva, hi, Adam Dolif Nei Dali Mishpat, my Darshibe. What do they do with that pasuk? They believe that the Gol Adam has a right to kill anytime. So what do they do with the pasuk that Rabbi Eliezer brings? Omi Baile, the Ketanyo. They need it for this right. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Minayin L'Sanhedrin, Shra'u Echad She'arag Et HaNefesh, She'im Mimitim Oto Ad She'amod V'Beit Din Acher. How do we know that if a Sanhedrin witnessed a murder, that they can't be the Beit Din for that murder? They become witnesses, and then they need to go testify in front of another Beit Din. Tamal Omar, Adam Dolif Ne'ayidah L'Mishpat, until they stand before an Eidah for Mishpat, Ad She'amod V'Beit Din Acher, until they go to another Beit Din. Here the Rishonim deal with something that we saw in Baba Kama, is that, as well as what we saw in Sanhedrin, number one is, Ein Eid Naseh Dayan. An Eid can't become a Dayan. Is this the source for that? Or why do we need a separate source of Ein Eid Naseh Dayan? Number two is, that we said there that there was a problem with the Beit Din that witnessed the murder, is because they can't perform B'Tzilu Ha'idah. They're going to be so biased in their trial, because they know that he murdered. They saw a murder. How are they going to ever do B'Tzilu Ha'idah? They can't act in that function. And that's why we don't allow them to be a Beit Din. So you actually have three different sources for the fact that a Beit Din that witnesses a murder can't be the sitting Beit Din. One is Ein Eid Naseh Dayan. The other one is that you can't be Kayim Mitzilu Eidah. And the third one is here. Adam Dol Lifnei Eidah L'Mishpat. The interaction between them is what the Rishonim deal with. Many believe that this is the major source. And the other things are just giving you reasons behind this source here. This is the Gzeret HaKatuv. Others see this as an asmachta, and the real reason being Ein Eid Naseh Dayan or B'Tzilu Ha'idah. The Ramban, for instance, says that when you say Ein Eid Naseh Dayan is only when the Beit Din witnessed it at night, because they can't be a sitting Beit Din at night, so they must be an Eid. Once they're an Eid, they can't be a Dayan. But if they witness it during the day, there's no restriction against Ein Eid Naseh Dayan. So then you'd have to invoke this principle in order to say they can't be the Beit Din, because Ein Eid Naseh Dayan wouldn't affect them. So that's another way to deal with it, is to say that each of those laws deals with a different area or a different issue that can come up for the Beit Din. The interplay between them is important. It's not really our sugya, but it relates to those other two sugyot that we saw before. Tanu Rabbanan, im yatzo yitzei harotzeach, says, if the rotzeach leaves, ein li ela b'mezid, if he leaves intentionally from the Eir Miklat, then he's subject to being killed by the Gol Adam. Bishogeg minayin. What happens if he accidentally or unintentionally leaves the Eir Miklat? How do we know that he is then subject to being killed by the Gol Adam? Tamalomar im yatzo yitzei mikol makom. The double lashon yatzo yitzei says no matter how he leaves the Eir Miklat, he's now open game for the Gol Adam. So that means that the Gol Adam has a right to kill him no matter why he's left the Eir Miklat. V'hatanya. Don't we have a braita? Over here, it's not clear what the question is, and it's not clear how to read the braita. It revolves around the word harogo. If you keep the word harogo in, then it's actually easy to read the braita, but then harder to understand why it's a question. If it says veharogo, someone who kills someone who left an ir miklat bishogeg, bitmezid, if he kills him intentionally, neharag. That person is going to be brought up on murder charges. Bishogeg, if the person kills them unintentionally, then they'll be put into galut. So then, if you read the braita that way, the question comes from the fact that shogeg is not free to be killed like a person who lives intentionally. What that braita is saying to you is someone who kills a person who unintentionally left the ir miklat, they're going to be subject to the regular rules of murder. And if you murder intentionally, you'll be put to death. If you murder unintentionally, then, or manslaughter, you will be taken to an ir miklat. So that would be the nature of the question. That's the way you read it. The problem is that many take out the word bahar go, including the ritva has the hagota gro, takes it out. So you have many who take out the harago over here and says this is the way to read the braita. Bit mezid ne'rag bishogeg gole. It's speaking about the person who's in galut. He's in the ir miklat. Bit mezid, if he leaves intentionally, ne'rag. He's open game. He can be killed. Bishogeg, if he leaves unintentionally, gole. We send him back to the ir miklat. So that's harder to read because gole means that you're putting him into galut, exile for the first time. Over here, it's bishogeg. If he leaves the ir miklat, gole, we put him back in the ir miklat. You would have just said machziro or something like that. Put him back. So that's why it's more difficult to read, but then it's exactly like the case we had before, which is now we have a distinction between mezid and shogeg. When the person leaves the city, but mezid, he's open game. Leaves bishogeg, then he goes back. So you would see that the statement before that we brought, that there's no distinction between mezid and shogeg, that's not true. It says, lokasha. Hakamad amar dibra Torah kalashon b'nei adam. That's like the one who says that the Torah speaks like the vernacular and there's poetic style in the Torah. The difference would be Yatso Yetze. Yatso Yetze is a duplicate Lashon, which seemingly is unnecessary. If you say that's a linguistic style, it's a poetic style, then you can't bring any meaning to it. It's simply the way the Torah writes things. It doesn't mean that you should bring any meaning to it. That'll be the braita that says there's a distinction between Mezid and Shogeg. Only if he leaves the city intentionally will be subject to this. Otherwise, not. The other one who says Yotso Yotse is a duplicate Lashon, and therefore it's subject to a limud, that would mean that if you leave Bishogeg, you would be Chayav, just like you are Chayav B'Mezid. And that'll be the first braita that we brought. Amar Abaye, Mistavra Gimand Amar Dibrat Torak Lashon B'nei Adam. Makes more sense according to the one who says that Dibrat Torak Lashon B'nei Adam. Shalei Sofo Chomor Mitzkilato. Why should his end be worse than his beginning? Matchilato, if the person kills, b'mezid, if it's intentional, it's murder, ne'rag, he's subject to a death penalty. Bishogeg, if he does it unintentionally, he goes into galut. Afsofo, also, once he's put into city arrest, once he's in city of refuge or sanctuary, then it should be the same thing. B'mezid, if he leaves intentionally, ne'rag, he'll be put to death. Bishogeg, goleh, I mean, he's put back into the ir miklat. It wouldn't make sense now that it's more chamor. He's now in the ir miklat. If he leaves unintentionally, he's going to get killed. So that's why he says there should be a parallel between his behavior in the beginning and his behavior now. Tani chada, we have one braita that says, Avsharag beno naseh lo goel adam. If a father kills one of his children, another one of the children will be the goel adam and can kill the father who had killed his brother. But tani yidach, we have another braita that says, Ein beno naseh lo goel adam. That a child may not be the goel adam for the father. Lei maha Rabbi Yossi Aglili, vaha Rabbi Akiva. Let us say that this is the machlok between Rabbi Yossi Aglili and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yossi Aglili says it's a mitzvah to be a goel adam, and Rabbi Akiva says it's only a reshut. So now you have the problem of kibud aveim. You have a parent who killed, chas v'shalom, their child, the brother of this individual. How much power does the child have to take revenge as the goel adam on the father? If it's a mitzvah to do it, it's an imperative to the Torah, then he would override, possibly, the restriction of kibud aveim. If it's only a reshut, if it's only optional, then that wouldn't override kibud aveim. So let us say that the difference in the opinions in the braita derive from whether you think the goel adam is a mitzvah to do it, or it's a reshut, it's optional. Gemara says, wait a minute. V'tizbara, ben the mandamar mitzvah, ben the mandamar reshut, mishari. Whether you think goel adam is a mitzvah or a reshut, since when is that mutar? V'amar rabba bar rabbuna, we saw this in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, a pehe on with bet, A child cannot act as a shliach of Beit Din to do these or carry out these punishments to his father, lahakoto, to give him malkot, lekalalato, to curse him, chutz mimesit, with the exception of a father who is a mesit. Shamrei Torah, the Torah gives a special dispensation there, where we know the Torah waives many requirements, including hatra'ah and other requirements, because it says, lo tachmol v'lo techase alav. You may not have mercy, you may not cover up for him. You have to do whatever you can to rid yourself of this mesit, the person who's causing people to worship Avodah Zarah or stray from the ways of the Torah. But what you see from this is, it doesn't really matter what it is. You have no right to do this to a parent. Even the mitzvah Beit Din, even a mitzvah to carry out, whatever it is, the child never has that right. If that's the case, it doesn't matter if the Gol Adam's a mitzvah or not a mitzvah, he can't beat the Gol Adam against the father. El Eloka shows the what is the resolution between the two brightot, ha-bibino, ha-beben-bino. That has to do with it, whether it's his child or his grandchild. So here you have an explanation of Rashi, which has huge implications, la-locha, which we'll speak about in a second. And you have the view of the Rabbeinu Hananel, which does not have huge implications, la-locha, because he's not addressing the same case. The Rabbeinu Hananel claims that the case over here is, parkinam, im esav harag teman ben Eliphaz. Esav kills his grandson, Teman, the son of Eliphaz. Eliphaz is his son. And he kills his grandson. Eliphaz nase gol adam shel beno. And Eliphaz can be the gol adam for his son that was killed by his father. Boreg Esav aviv, and he's allowed to kill his father. So in that case, he's a gol adam for his own child. In that case, he has a right to kill his father who killed his child. Aval, imarag Esav re'uel beno. If Esav killed his own son, who is the brother of Eliphaz, then over there, ain Eliphaz gol adam achiv mi'adaviv. He may not be the gol adam for his brother. So the way that the Rabbeinu Hananel learns the Gemara over here, there's a distinction between whether you're the gol adam for your brother, or if you're the gol adam for your son. If you're gol adam for your son, then you have the right to kill even your father. If you're the gol adam for your brother, then you have no right to kill the father. So that has to do with the nature of the Gol Adam. Where is the relationship here? Is it a brother or a son? That's Rabbeinu Hananel's explanation. It's hard to understand because it seemed before the Gemara said you can't ever be a Gol Adam neged the father. So the answer might be there, which is when it's the father's own son that he had killed, the brother can't be the Gol Adam in that situation. And that's what it means there. You don't have a right taking retribution on your father for something his father did to himself in a sense. He did it to his own son. Then if it's done to a grandson, the grandfather to the grandson, that separation already makes it that it's considered to be as if it's a third party, the grandson, and therefore father of that child that was killed, who's the son of the murderer, has a right to be a gol adam in that case and take out his father. That's Rabbeinu Hananel's explanation. It's very difficult. Rashi, on the other hand, says it has to do with whether the child or grandchild is the gol adam. If the father kills a child, one of the other children, one of the brothers, may not be a gol adam to kill his father because of kibud avim. On the other hand, if a father kills his son, the son's son, the grandson, can be the gol adam and kill his grandfather who killed his father. That, why is that the case? Rashi makes a comment here, which has huge halachic ramifications. Shu ben benosha rutzeach, the grandson can be the gol adam of the murderer. Ve'enu muzhar al kibodo, because he is not commanded to give kavod to his grandfather. The requirement is kibud av ve'em, and that's why you can't be a gol adam to take out the father. A grandchild to a grandfather, there is no such relationship. Therefore, a grandchild has a right to kill his grandfather, and the grandchild beat the gol adam for his own father, because he has no requirement, there's no imperative of kibud av ve'em. So that's an amazing statement of Rashi. And that brings up a whole literature about what is the relationship between a grandchild and a grandparent. What obligations does a grandchild have towards the grandparents? There are three basic ways to look at this, a shitot here. One is what Rashi says over here. There is none. There are no obligations from a grandson to a grandfather. There is no Torah prescribed necessity for him to begin kavod to his grandfather. The requirement is kibud avim, and that is it. There are two other views here about the obligation of a grandchild to have kavod for the grandparent. One of them, which would be the middle position, is that there is no independent obligation for the child to have kavod for his grandfather, but through a transitive property, they have an obligation. Since you have an obligation to honor your parents, and your parents have an obligation to honor their parents, on a derivative basis, you also have an obligation to respect your grandparents, because that is respecting your parents. We have other things like that with regards to spouses or a child, for instance. It says that a child is chayav b'kibud aveim, and a wife has to give kavod to her baal, to her husband. So if a child has a choice in giving precedence in kavod to his father or to his mother, the Gemara says that you give precedence to the father, because the child is chayav in the kavod of the father. The mother is also chayavet in the kavod of her husband. So even when the child is giving kavod to his mother, that same requirement of giving kavod to his mother is also to give kavod to his father. And for that reason, through the transitive property, the son is obligated through the mother to give kavod to the father. For that reason, the father would take precedence. Or with spouses, even though, again, there's maybe no requirement in in-laws for kibud avim, but maybe through the spouse there's a requirement. Because you have to treat your spouse properly, and that spouse has an obligation towards their parents, therefore you also might have an obligation towards the parents. So that's one way to do it, that's expressed, that there is an obligation on the child, but it all derives from the parent. There is a third view, which is that children have an obligation of kavod for their grandparents. If they have an obligation for kavod to their parents, then certainly they have an obligation towards their grandparents, but it derives from kibud avim, because of b'nei banim, harien kibanim. Grandchildren are considered like children, and so we equate generations, we flatten generations, and say grandchildren and children are all the same thing, and therefore from kibud avim, you have a requirement to give honor to your grandparents, if it's because of that. Or because of the fact that you go, which says that, Hodatam lebanecha libnei banecha, says in Devarim that you have an obligation to teach Torah to your children and to your grandchildren. Your grandparents, as part of that mesorah, you have an obligation to respect them out of that. And that would be a third view, that there's actually a direct obligation from the grandchild to the grandparent. Now, Rashi in Chumash brings another view, which actually is in contradiction to what he brings over here. And that is by Yaakov Avinu, after he finds out that Yosef's alive, and goes down to Mitzrayim. On his way down to Mitzrayim, he stops in Beersheba and brings korbanot. And it says, he gives korbanot to his God of his father Yitzchak. Rashi on the spot says, why does it say Elokei Aviv Yitzchak, velo Elokei Aviv Abraham? Why does it only say Elokei Yitzchak? Where's Elokei Abraham? So Rashi over there says something interesting, which he quotes the Midrash Rabbah, which says, Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Shechayav Adam Bichvod Aviv, Yoter Mikvod Zkeino. A person has an obligation towards father, much more so than towards his grandfather. Implicit in those words are, there is an obligation towards the grandfather, it's just not as high as the obligation towards the parent. But that would be against what Rashi is saying here, and say that there is an obligation towards a grandparent. That is even expanded upon by the Sefer Chassidim. The Sefer Chassidim says something very interesting, which he says that there's some mitzvot that people can't do because they're missing a piece of the puzzle. Whether that's because they're not a Kohen, they're not a Levi, they're not Israel, so they can't do some mitzvot. The Sefer Chassidim says that there are always other things you can do that simulate the effect of that mitzvah. He says it with regards to kibud avim. What happens to a child or a person that never saw his parents? The parents passed away, and so he can never be mekayim kibud avim. So what does he do? Where's his kibud avim? Where's that mitzvah for him? So he says, v'yesh lo zakeim zkeinav. He has grandparents. Harzei yikayim aleihem mitzvat kibud kilu hu b'neihem. He'll try to treat the grandparents like parents and give them kavod. Or if he didn't see them, he has older brothers. So there are ways to simulate kibud avim. The Sefer Chassidim says one of the ways is if a person doesn't have parents, that they treat their grandparents like parents. So that has two implications. One is, first, it sounds like that's only because he didn't have parents. So you could argue that if he has parents, then there's no obligation. Or he's telling you that kibud of zkenim, of grandparents, has a part and parcel of kibud avim. It's a derivative of the mitzvah. Okay, it's not like kibud avim full-fledged, but it is a manifestation of kibud avim. So that's a very expanded Sefer Chassidim, which sees much broader application to kibud avim than just simply parents. And that leads to a major machlok between the Marik and the Ramah, the Halacha. All these types of machlokot and Halacha come up always with emotional issues. Because when emotional issues, that's when people really get worked up about it, and they really feel strongly about it. That came to individuals who did not have parents, but had grandparents, and the grandparents brought them up. When the grandparent passes away, does the grandchild have the right to say Kaddish for the grandparent? Now, the right, you ask, that's because the way that we say Kaddish today, which is everybody says Kaddish together, so what's the big deal if he says Kaddish for the grandparent? But in the days then when they gave the Kaddish, there was only one person in the shul said Kaddish for every Kaddish. If you award the right to the individual to say Kaddish to a grandparent, you're taking away one of the Kaddishim that's available to a child that's saying Kaddish for the parents. Do you have a right to do such? The Shutta Marik says no, that there is no din of a grandchild saying Kaddish for a grandparent, and therefore he has no right to displace a child saying Kaddish for a parent. And he quotes our Rashi over here and all the different Mefarshim and the different things that we saw before to discuss this, and he concludes that there is no right or there's no obligation on the grandchild to say Kaddish for the grandparent because there's no Kibud Av Aim from a grandchild to a grandparent. What about the fact that the Gemara tells us B'nei Banim, Hari Hen Kibbanim? That seems to be a strong case for the fact that grandparents have the same status as parents. He says that's only said in the Gemara Nivamot with regards to whether Yibum has to be performed. It's only in Puria Beridya. Mitzvot that deal with procreation or deal with whether you have children or not, that's where B'nei Banim, Hari Hen Kibbanim, which means that for a Yavam, you don't have to perform Yibum if there are grandchildren. And also for Puria Beridya, you can accomplish Puravu through grandchildren, not just through children. But outside of that realm, we don't use the term B'nei Banim, Hari Hen Kibbanim. That's the conclusion of the Marik. The Shulta Rama, the Rama in Shulchan Aruch actually writes, after the Shulchan Aruch brings the Aloha down, Karev Adam L'Chabed Chamiv, person has to give honor to their father-in-law, Haga. Yesh Ramim De'en Adam Chayab B'Chvod Avi Aviv. Rama brings down that there are some people who say that you don't have any obligation to honor your grandparents. And he quotes that from the Maharik. He says, V'eino nirali. The Ramah says, I don't think that's right. Ela d'chaya b'chvod aviv, yoter m'chvod aviv. You have more of an obligation towards your parents, but you still have an obligation towards your grandparents. And he references you to the Pasuk in Breshit with Elokei Avi Yitzchak, which is that Rashi that brings the Midrash Rabbah that says that you're chayav in your quote of your parents much more so than your grandparents. But that means that you do have an obligation. That's what he says in Shulchan Aruch, but if you look up the Shuta Rama, he speaks much more strongly about that, and it's about a case exactly like this, where an individual's parents had passed away, and the grandparents had brought him up, and then the grandfather's going to pass away, and he wants the grandchild to say Kaddish for him. And they write to the Rama asking, what's the din over here? Can the grandchild say Kaddish for me? And the Rama writes back, yes, the grandchild can't say Kaddish. He says, I want a letter from you saying that that's the case so that I can take it to shul and tell them that daddy can say Kaddish, meaning that the people are not going to let him. But the Rama does concede a little bit and says that it should not be an even breakdown between a grandchild and a child. Rather, two-thirds of the Kaddishim should go to people who are children for parents. And he could get one-third of the mix, which is he doesn't get a full right. He gets a curtailed right to say Kaddish. But the Rama there says very strongly that grandchildren and grandparents, and he says, especially in this instance where the parents had passed away and the grandparents had brought the child up and paid for his Torah education and done everything that he needed, that certainly the grandchild should have a right to say Kaddish for the grandparents and treat them like parents. So obviously that has major ramifications halakhically because of this idea of Kaddish today. I guess it's less emotional or an issue because everybody says Kaddish together, but the right of a grandchild to say Kaddish for a grandparent is somewhat governed by this. And also might be impactful in terms of if the parents are still alive and grandparents pass away. You have this many times where you only have daughters and there are grandsons. So since the granddaughters are not going to say Kaddish, they have grandsons, can they say Kaddish? So there's a question of whether that can be done even without permission of the parents. The Shutta Rama sounds like that it's possible even without permission of the parents. Others suggest that you need to get permission from the parents to say Kaddish. If one of the parents had passed away already, then you might even not need to seek permission of the other parent to say Kaddish because of the obligation to say Kaddish for the person that passed away. Then you might have a right to say Kaddish even without permission of the other spouse. So that's most people feel that that's the case. And again, that's discussed by the Achronim over here as to how far this goes, as well as other implications which have to derive from things that we discussed in the Gemara and Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, we discussed the fact as to whether a child can perform medical services for a parent. Is that possibly a violation of Kibud Av V'Aim or problems of Mate Aviv V'Imo? And so over there, we concluded that a person should try not to treat medically their parents because of the problem of maybe by accident they'll cause them to bleed or give them a makah. Does that have application by grandparents? So those are the types of tshuvot you have here, meaning that when you say that you have obligation of kibud zdenim, kibud of grandparents, what is that versus the kibud of parents? How strong is that? Does it have the same dinim as parents or different dinim? It also has to do with whose monetary obligation is. Do you have to spend money to do that? Generally, kibud av v'aim comes out of the parents' pocket. If the parents can't afford it, the child has to pay for it. What happens now with the grandparents who can't afford it? Is there an obligation on the grandchild to pay for a kibud of their grandparents? The child can't afford it, but the grandchild can. Is there an obligation on the grandchild? Those are the types of questions that come up here and have relevance with regards to whether there is any obligation of kibud av v'aim with regards to grandparents. And obviously impacted by the Rashi here, it says, that there is no din at all. Again, Rashi on Chumash, who quotes the Midrash Rabbah, seems to be soter this, but from this Rashi, it would sound like there is no din of Kibud Av V'Aim with regards to grandparents. Alright, next Mishnah. Ilan shel meid v'tochat tchum, if you have a tree within the area of the tchum, periphery of the Yermiklat, and the branches go outside the tchum, or the tree, the trunk of the tree is outside the periphery, perimeter of the city, and the branches come into the city, everything is determined by the nof. Gemara will discuss what exactly that means. What type of implications does it mean that it goes after the nof? Does that mean that the branches are independent from the trunk, or does that mean the branches actually determine what the status of the trunk is? Birimini, is it really true that the nof, the branches, determine where the tree is? Ilan shomeid v'notel l'chutz, if you have a tree that is standing, this is in Yerushalayim, and its branches go outside the wall of the city, omeid v'chutz, or a tree is outside the city of Yerushalayim, v'notel l'fnim, and branches go into the city, mikineged achoma v'lifnim k'lifnim, anything that's opposite the wall and towards the inside is considered to be inside. Anything that is opposite the wall outward is considered to be outward. You basically drop a plumb line on the wall. Anything to the inside is considered inside. Anything to the outside is outside. So you basically, the dividing line is the wall itself. We don't say anything about acharanof. So the Gemara says, Maser arei miklat karomit. You're asking a question from Maser Sheni. To Ari Miklat, Maaser Sheni, that must be eaten inside of Yerushalayim. Maaser b'choma talo rachmona. Maaser is determined by the wall. That Rashi says is because it says, Lifnei Hashem Elokecha tochlenu. You have to eat it before Hashem. Anything inside the walls of Yerushalayim is considered to be Lifnei Hashem. Or the Pasuk that the Rabbeinu Chananel quotes is, any makom that is there is considered Lifnei Hashem Elokecha. So that wall is the determining factor by Maser. Arei Miklat, Bedira Tal Rachmano. Arei Miklat, it says Vayeshiv Ba, that he has to live there, so it has to do with dwelling. Be'nofo mitadarle, in the branches one lives, Bikaro lo mitadar. But in the trunk, the one does not live. It's not clear here whether that means that one lives on the branches or in the branches, but doesn't live in the trunk. Or does it mean under the trunk? You can't live under the trunk. But you can live under the branches. So the branches do facilitate the ability to live, and therefore they're called dira, and they're important by the Ari Miklat. The trunk doesn't have that status. So from that way, the Gemara says, you're right, you have two different ways of determining over here, but that's precipitated by the different dinim. Maaser Sheni is a din in the Yerushalayim, being inside Yerushalayim, inside the walls. As long as you're inside the walls, you're fine. For Ari Miklat, it's about where you can live. Where you can live is considered a part of the Arei Miklat. What you can't live under is not considered a part of the Arei Miklat. Tosafot over here raises the issue that in Yerushalayim there's a din that gagot lo nitkadshu. The roofs of the houses were not kadosh, what the status of Yerushalayim. So he wants to understand how could it be that the branches of the tree would have a status of kushat Yerushalayim for Maaser Sheni if the roofs, things that are off the ground, don't have that status. So Tosafot brings one of two different reasons. Either anafav muatim, that it's a tree that doesn't have large number of branches. It's not as if you're standing on a roof, but rather it's as if you're in the airspace of Yerushalayim, and that would be sufficient. Or that it's a case where the Elam has a ton of branches, and despite that fact, Avir Yerushalayim is Yerushalayim. Being up in the airspace of Yerushalayim is considered to be part of Yerushalayim. So Gagol Lo Nitkashu is particular to a roof, because then the roof is Bumvatel, the Avir Yerushalayim. But here we have a tree. The tree doesn't affect the fact that you're up in the airspace. Anything in the airspace of Yerushalayim is considered to be fine. Now the Gemara says, Barami Maser Amaser. Why are you only asking from Maser and Ari Miklat? I'll bring you a stira within Maser Sheni itself. The Tanya is what we have in the Gemara, but as you can see, many change it to Ditnan. We have a Mishnah. Yerushalayim Aleich Acharanuf. Yerushalayim, you go after the branches. Ari Miklat Aleich Acharanuf. And so too, by Ari Miklat, you go after the Nuf. So here, now you have a problem. Before, you wanted to suggest that there was a distinction between Arei Miklat and Maaser Sheni, because Arei Miklat were determined by Dira and Maaser Sheni by Choma. Here you have a Mishnah that says that Arei Miklat and Maaser Sheni have the same din, and they follow the Nuf. So that would undermine the distinction that you drew. So Amar Rav Kana, Lo Kasha, that's not a problem. Amar Rav Yehuda, HaRabbonon. That is authored by Rav Yehuda, and that is authored by the Rabbonon. Titania, we have a Braita that explains the position of Rav Yehuda, and from that we can understand what's happening over here. When it comes to caves, you go after the opening of the cave. So wherever the cave opens, if it opens, let's say, inside the Irmiklat, then you have a din of an Irmiklat. Opens outside the Irmiklat, because it has outside the Irmiklat. Yerushalayim, the cave opens up into Yerushalayim, it's like Yerushalayim. It's out of Yerushalayim, it's not. Bilan, with trees, Aleich Achar Anuf. By trees, you go after the branches. So here you have Rabbi Yehuda saying this about Maaser Sheni, and now you're trying to apply this and say that's a broader machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim with regards to how we determine where the borderline is. And now we're suggesting is that Aleich Achar Anuf is the position of Rabbi Yehuda. That means that Rabbi Yehuda is the author of our Mishnah that says Aleich Achar Anuf. Rabbi Yehuda is also the author of that Mishnah in Masrot that says that both Maaser Sheni and Arei Miklat follow Achar Anuf. And the one Mishnah that we brought from Maaser Sheni that said that it's cut, the line cuts it based on the wall, that'll be the Shita of the Chachamim. So that would be the explanation that we would give at this point based on the fact that it's a Machloket from Yehuda and the Chachamim. So at this point we're rejecting that distinction we made between Maaser and Arei Miklat and suggesting that it has to do with positions of two Tanaim. And Rav Kahana is saying that it's a machloket, Rav Yehuda and Chachamim, and not a fundamental difference between Maaser Sheni and Arei Miklat, even though the Gemara didn't say Ela Amar Rav Kahana, which usually implies a rejection of the previous answer, but the fact that he shows you that there is this machloket Tanaim, which makes the previous distinction somewhat moot. The Gemara says, Imor Dishmait Le the Rav Yehuda, it makes sense what Rav Yehuda is saying with regards to Maaser Sheni, Gabe Maaser Lechumra. Because by Maaser, you're going to Chumrah. Ikaro b'chutz, b'nofo b'fnim. If the trunk is outside the city, b'nofo b'fnim, and the branches are inside the city, k'eche d'nofo lo matziparik, just like on the branches, you can't redeem it, b'ikaro name lo matziparik, so too on the trunk, you can't redeem it. Ikaro mi b'fnim, if the trunk is inside, b'nofo b'chutz, and the branches are outside, k'eche d'nofo lo matziakil, just like on the branches, you can't eat the Maaser Sheni, below Ptia, without redeeming it. Bikaronami, so too on the trunk, lo matziachel below Ptia. You can't eat there without having redeemed it. What the Gemara has pointed out over here is, with regards to Maaser Sheni and the cutoff of the wall of Yerushalayim, there's both a kula and a chumra associated with being in the city and being outside the city. That is, the rule is, one is allowed to redeem Maaser Sheni up to Yerushalayim, as long as you're outside the walls of Yerushalayim. If you enter Yerushalayim, you're no longer allowed to redeem the Maaser Sheni unto money. Vice versa, when it comes to eating a Maaser Sheni, you can only eat Maaser Sheni inside of Yerushalayim. You cannot eat Maaser Sheni outside of Yerushalayim. So it turns out that outside of Yerushalayim is a chumrah for eating. You can't eat outside of Yerushalayim. Inside of Yerushalayim is a chumrah for p'diyah, for redemption. What the Gemara is saying is, maybe Rabbi Yehuda's position is a chumrah position. He agrees fundamentally with the Chachamim that the cutoff is the wall. But he says that you go the Chumrah when you have a tension between the tree's trunk and the branches. Since the branches can draw the tree, because the branches are considered to be the Ikar, the most important part of it, they'll pull the trunk along with it. But they're only pull it the Chumrah. Which means that if you have a tree inside the city, the trunk on the side of the city, and the branch is outside, so now we're going to say that the branches pull the tree out of the city. You would have been able to eat Maisur Sheni on this trunk because it's inside the city. But since the branches are outside, the Chumrah, they're going to pull it outside. But only for that. We're not going to say now it's considered outside that you can redeem it on the trunk in the city. No, no, no. And vice versa. If the trunk is outside the city and the branches are leaning in, if you said you go after the branches, that would allow you to eat Maisur Sheni on the tree or the trunk that's outside the city. That we don't say. We say it's the Chumrah. The branches inside the city pull the tree into the city for Ptiyah, that you're no longer allowed to redeem Maisur Sheni because it's considered to be in Yerushalayim. With regards to eating of Maisur Sheni, it still would be considered outside of Yerushalayim. Now, as far as the status of the branches of the tree, for instance, in the case where the branches are inside the city and the trunk is outside the city, you said according to Rabbi Yehuda, it's a chumrah that we pull the tree inside and you can't redeem on the trunk on the outside. The question is, with regards to eating Maisur Sheni, what's the status of the branches? Are the branches considered to be inside? They just don't pull the ikar. They just don't pull the trunk along. Or are the branches now also, because of the ikar that's outside of the city, the branches now are also subject to not being allowed to eat inside the city. So Tosafot says that we go achar nofo the chumrah, but that doesn't affect the nof itself. We say the nof pulls the ikar of the chumrah, but we're not going to say then that the nof is affected by the ikar in the other direction. Although the Tosafot Yom Tov wants to be medayik out of Rashi, that it's bidirectional, and that both the ikar will pull the nof, and the nof will pull the ikar, and it'll go the chumrah in both directions. That's a machloket in the Rishonim, as to what the status of the branches are in that situation. Do we say that you bite to the chumrah to both sides, that the ikar and the branches pull you in each direction, and therefore you'll be a chumrah both for p'tiyah and for eating? Or do we say that the chamim's position, if the wall cutting it, is the halacha, and only if the branches make it a chumrah, do we follow, make the ikar follow the branches? Now, Tzbali at Tosafot already asked over here, Imar Rashmeit, how do they know that that's the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda? Since when do you know that Rabbi Yehuda is Bechumra? Maybe Rabbi Yehuda says Meikar Din, that we go after the Nuf. So Tosafot says, Misvara. It's a logical argument in order to narrow the machlok between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. If you say Rabbi Yehuda ignores the line cut and doesn't say the Chumra, he says, go after the Nuf no matter what, that would open up a much bigger gulf between Rabbi Yehuda's position and the Chachamim's position. The way that the Gemara is stating it, logically says that the machloket is much narrower, and the Gemara prefers to have a narrower machloket, and therefore they believe that that must be the position of Rabbi Yehuda, which is that he's only the chumrah. He agrees fundamentally that the wall is the cutoff, except that the branches can pull you, the chumrah, to another direction and say you can't do something that you would otherwise thought you could do if the tree was inside or outside of the city. So Gemara says, okay, that works well for Maisur Sheni, that you can say Rabbi Yehuda is the chumrah, but in the case where the trunk is outside the city or outside the limits of the city, and the branches are inside, just like Yigol Adam can't kill the person when he's on the branches of the tree, so too he can't kill him when he is on the trunk of the tree. So what you see here, it's important to note this, that the Kula and Chumrah, with regards to Ari Miklat, is from the perspective of the Goel Adam. The truth is that if you have it from the perspective of the person inside the city who is incarcerated there, then it would be just the opposite in terms of a Chumrah and Kula. The Gemara sees the Chumrah and Kula as to whether the Goel Adam has a right to kill him or not. So over here, if you have the trunk outside the perimeter, the Tchum of the city, and you have the branches leaning in, then just like he cannot kill him on the branches inside, he also can't kill him on the trunk on the outside because the branches pull the trunk in. So that would be the chumrah. Ella, in the case be karobifnim and ofo bachot, when the trunk is inside the tchum and the branches go outside the tchum, you can't say just like the Goel Adam can kill him on the branches that are outside the tchum, be karonami matzi kotile. Now you're going to say that you can also kill him on the trunk that is sitting inside the city. That's not a chumrah. That is a kula and hakavaykoi. That trunk is sitting literally inside the city. You're going to say the Goel Adam can kill him on the trunk inside the city? That doesn't make so much sense. So Amarova biikaro. We're going to continue with the explanation that the difference between them is Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, but we're going to reinterpret it so that this problem of the Chumrah is not an issue by the Ari Miklat. And that is biikaro kuliyama pulpligate lo matzikotil. Everybody agrees that you can't kill on the trunk. So now, kai begufo, v'yachol orgo b'chitzim u'tzurot, to kol yam elo pegi dematzikotule. In addition, if he's on the branches that are hanging outside the tchum, and the goladam is able to kill him with the arrows or with throwing stones at him, there also we'll say there is no penalty against the goladam for doing such. Everybody agrees that the trunk, when it's inside the city, is protective and the branches don't pull him out. Number two is the branches on the outside, since they're independent. If he's in the branches on the outside, he can kill him without any problem. So that way, it will turn out to be the chumrah in both situations, which is that as far as the trunk on the outside, the branches inside, that'll take the whole tree in and make it that you're not allowed to kill on it. If the trunk is on the inside and the branches are outside, then the trunk for sure is classified as inside and you can't kill him there. On the branches, he will have a right to kill him because the branches are more chashuv than the ikar. Ki plige, so then when is there machloget? Ikarov dargala nofo. If he needs to go up the trunk to access the nof, to access him on the branches. Mar sabarvi ikaro dargala nofo. One of them believes that the ikar, meaning that the trunk is a stepping stone to the nof. Mar sabarvi ikaro dargala nofo. And the other one holds that it is not a stepping stone to the branches. So Rabbeinu Chananel notes over here, review the savar. Rabbeinu is the one who says, ikaro dargala nofo, that the trunk is a stepping stool to the branches, and because of that, he has a right to go on the trunk to get to the branches. Since the branches are outside the city, and the trunk is subordinated to the branches, if he climbs up the trunk to get to those branches and kill him outside, that's fine, because the trunk is subordinated to the branches, even though it's found inside. So he may not kill him on the trunk on the inside, but he's allowed to use the trunk from the inside to get to the branches on the outside. On the other hand, the Chachamim say that the trunk is not a stepping stone to the branches. They're considered to be independent entities. They're independent entities that the branches on the outside, if he kills them in those branches, it's fine. The trunk on the inside is protected, and you may not use the trunk to access the branches that are outside. As Rashi says over here, Kuli Alma Nof Batari Karo Lo Shadina. Everybody agrees that the branches can't follow the trunk. The only question is, does the trunk follow the branches? We say here that if the trunk is on the inside and the branches are outside, then the trunk for sure is classified as inside and you can't kill him there. With the one exception as to a question if they use the trunk to access the branches. Is the trunk considered subordinate to the branches and that's okay? And that's what Rabbi Yehuda means by Hochim Aparanof. Or is the trunk independent, then you can't use the trunk as the access route to get to the branches because the trunk is inside of the city. And Tosfot says, how does Rabbi know that we even have such a machloket over here? That's based on the fact that the Mishnah that we brought equates Arei Miklat to Yerushalayim. And so just like we have a machloket by Yerushalayim, it must be that there's a machloket by Arei Miklat. And that's what precipitates Rabbah's explanation over here. So that's Rabbah's solution. And Rabbah's solution basically says that we accept the distinction between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim as being the authors of these different things. Rabbi Yehuda will be the author of the Mishnah that says Arei Miklat and Maaser are the same. You'll also be the author of our Mishnah, and you asked about the fact that it's not the Chumrah. No, in Ochanami, here, by Ari Miklat, we're also going L'Chumrah, and saying that the nof and the trunk are considered to be separate, so it's not the Kula, it's going L'Chumrah, but the only question is the trunk a stepping stool to the branches? Whereas the Chachamim, the author of that one Mishnah in Maaser Sheni, that says that we go after the plumb line of the wall with regards to Maaser Sheni, and because of that, the nof is outside and the trunk is on the inside, the trunk's off limits for the Goel Adam for that reason, or in Yerushalayim, you'd be allowed to eat Maaser Sheni on the trunk, even though you can't eat it on the branches. Rav Ashi Amar, Mai Achar Anof, Af Achar Anof. So Rav Ashi comes along and says, what does it mean, Achar Anof? Means Af, also after the nof. Where the nof generates a Chumrah, we also go after the nof. Where the generates a kula, we will not follow it. And so what Rav Ashi basically is saying is, Rabbi Yehuda basically acquiesces to the position of the Chachamim, with the exception of cases by which the nof will make it more chamur. So Rashi believes that Rav Ashi, in essence, is mekabel robo's shita, but he just says, in addition to that, it's only afakar nof, only when it is the chumrah. Which means that according to Rava, if the nof is outside the city and the ikar is inside the city, According to Rabbi Yehuda, and according to the Chachamim in that case, you can kill the individual in the nof, if he's outside, that's chum. Whereas the trunk that's inside, you can't kill them there. What Rav Ashi comes along to say is, no, also there we go the chumrah, and since the ikar is inside the city, the nof will be pulled into the city. And when we say afachar nof, means also the nof will cause a chumrah. So normally, the ikar, the trunk of the tree, is what determines where the tree is. So that is a given. As Rashi notes over here, that's because anywhere else in the Torah, it seems like the branches always follow the trunk. And the trunk is considered to be the ikar. Since Ari Meklider, the exception where the trunk follows the branches because of dira, which makes the branches more important, we will only follow them le chumra, but not the kula. But then what we're saying is afakar nof means that even in a case where the nof now would change the status to chumra, then we'll also follow the nof. Which means now if the base or the trunk of the tree is inside the city and the nof is outside, we do like anywhere else, we go after the ikar of the tree, the whole tree is considered in the city. On the other hand, when you have the trunk outside the limits of the city and the branches inside, then we say af achar nof, also following the nof over here, that'll pull the tree inside the city. And that means that it'll go the chumrah in both directions. You'll follow the ikar or the nof, whichever brings you a situation which gets you the tree inside the limits. That is a chumrah that the Goel Adam cannot kill in that situation. So that's the view of Rashi. So according to Rashi, that the follow the ikar is a given. The chiddush is the fact that you also follow the nof, the chumrah, when it helps you out in that situation. Tosafot questions the position of Rashi, and therefore offers an alternative view of what Ravashi's position is, the kach necha perish aram. The Baal Yad Tosafot say that that's not the case. The nof and the ikar are always independent. That means in a case where the ikar is inside and the nof is outside, the nof will not follow the ikar, because the nof is always independent from the ikar. And that's what he's saying over here. The only thing he's saying, that ah kachar nof kachumra, means that when the nof is on the inside, it'll pull the ikar in. So even though the ikar can stand independently in the reverse situation, it will pull the tree in when the trunk is outside and the branches are inside. And that's what it means, apachara nof, that even though generally the ikar stands independently, over here we'll let the nof pull the ikar in. But vice versa, it will not be true. The nof will always be independent, and the ikar can't pull it into the city. If the nof is outside the city, then if he gets killed there, that would be okay according to the Baal Yad Tosafot. Whereas for Rashi, when the branches are outside the limits and the trunk is inside, according to Rav Ashi, with him, it would follow the ikar and it would be pulled into the city. But in that way, he would end up explaining like Rava, just with the exception of the machloket about whether it's a stepping stone or not a stepping stone. He leaves that out by just saying afachar nof. By doing that, he can say that the machloket between them is whether the nof can pull the ikar into the city. And that's the chiddush over there. That's what we say is the chumra, afachar nof. That's the view of the Baal Yad Tosafot. According to both Rashi and Tosafot, that's only by Ir Miklat, but not by Maisur Sheni. Although the Baal Amor suggests that this din has application not only by Ari Miklat, but also by Maisur Sheni. The Rosh Mishant in his Perush on Mishnayot actually brings a totally different Perush, which says that Rav Ashi rejects Rova completely and goes back to our original assumption that there's a difference between Maisur Sheni and Ari Miklat, that Maisur Sheni is governed by the wall, Ari Miklat are governed by the Nof or the Makom Dira. And as to your question about the Chumrah, the answer of Rav Ashi is Af Achar Anof, which means that by Maisur Sheni, we always go, it's a Chumrah when you walk Achar Anof in either direction. Over here, by Ari Miklat, he's showing you that we only go after the Nof when it is the Chumrah. And so then it'll be the same as Maisur Sheni. We don't go after Achar Anof all the time. We go after the Nof when it is the Chumrah. And that's how he explains Rav Ashi's position over here. Right now, next Mishnah. Haran Botai here. If a person is already in Galut, in an Ir Miklat, because he killed Bishogeg, and he kills again Bishogeg inside that city, Golem Mishkuna Lishkuna, he has to move from neighborhood to neighborhood in that city. Uben Levi Golem Ir the Ir. And Uben Levi has to move from city to city. Rashi over here notes that there's a key difference between a Levi and someone in Ir Miklat. The person in Ir Miklat can't leave the Ir Miklat. So the only option for him in terms of Galut is to move from one neighborhood to the other neighborhood. On the other hand, the Ben Levi has a right to leave his city, because he only lives there because it's one of the Ariel Levi'im. So since he has a right to leave the city, and he killed Meshogeg, then he should leave the city and go to another Ir Miklat. The reason being that when a person moves from Shkuna to Shkuna within the city, Rashi over here says that he has to stay in the new neighborhood. He's now narrowed his incarceration. Until now, he was under city arrest. Now he's under neighborhood arrest, which means that he's got to stay in that neighborhood and he can't leave that neighborhood. The exile has to have increased from what it was before. Before, the exile was out the city limits. Now that he killed again, he's now narrowed the scope of the limits to the neighborhood. So that's the view of Rashi. Others say that it works the other way around, which is once he leaves his shkuna, which he has to do, he can't return to that shkuna. He can live anywhere else in the city besides the shkuna, besides the neighborhood where he came from. So that would be explanation of shkuna to shkuna. And again, Ben Levi goes from city to city. Now whether that's, like Rashi says, because he can leave the city, or whether that's good advice, because if he leaves the city, he can actually go to the other city and then be free to move around the city, the entire city. Whereas if he stays in his own city, we're going to see in the Gemara, he's entitled to do that, then he have a much narrower scope of where he can go or move in the city. Alright, so here, the Gemara is quoting from Mishpatim, where it says, "Kasher lo tzadav elukim inal yado, v'samti lecha makom asher yanus shama." I will create a place where you can run away to. So Gemara Darshan, "V'samti lecha b'chayecha," during your lifetime, means during the lifetime of Moshe Rabbeinu, "makom," a place, "mimkomcha," your place, "asher yanus shama," that they will be able to run away. "Milamei," this teaches you, "Shayu Yisrael migalim b'midbar," that there were actually cities of refuge in the midbar. "Ve'echad migalim," where do they go? "The Machane Leviyah." They have to go to the Machane Leviyah, where Moshe Rabbeinu is. So the way that Rashi learns it over here is, "Samtin lacha b'chayecha," Rashi learns this, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "I will let you set up some of the Arei Miklat in your lifetime," which Rashi claims are the three Arei Miklat in Eivar Yardain. On the other hand, the Oroch over here suggests that "Samtin lacha b'chayecha" means that in your lifetime, there will be Arei Miklat that are associated with you, meaning referencing to the remainder of the Braita that says that the area of the Nevi'im was also a place of sanctuary. That's number one. "Mimkomcha," then beyond that, he teaches him that your place where you live will also be an Ir Miklat. Rashi over here says that means that your neighborhood or where you live in the Midbar will function as an area of sanctuary. And similarly, when Bnei Yisrael go into Eretz Yisrael, the area of the Nevi'im will function as sanctuaries or places of refuge. Another hand, Rashi in Zvachim says, "Makom" means "mimkomcha," which means that even you will have a place to go for a sanctuary, which is the idea that is borne out, we're going to see afterwards in the Braita, that "mimkomcha," starting from you, or where you are, there will be sanctuary, and that'll be the source actually for later on, when we say that if Ben Levi, if he stays in his own city, that there is refuge. And so that's what it means, "mimkomcha." Your makom will provide refuge for you, in a sense, even though you aren't moving from one place to another. Kanamru, from here you conclude, Ben Levi Sharag, Goleh. A Ben Levi that kills is Goleh, Levi Pelach the Pelach. He is taken from Pelach the Pelach. According to Rashi, that means Medina the Medina. From district to district, or region to region. Or basically, the halacha is that you have to move. The Levi, like our Mishnah says, the Levi moves from city to city, because the Arei Levi'im function as places of sanctuary. Im galah lefolcho, if he goes to his own city, polcho koto, it works. Amar Rabacha Breda Ravika Maikra, what is the pasuk? It says, ki bi ir miklato yeshev, ir shekolto kvar. In ir miklato, he will stay. So that means the ir that already he's in, he may remain in. So now, here you have two pieces to the puzzle. The first of which is, Mikan Amru, Ben Levi Sharag Golem, Mipelach the Pelach, which is that Ben Levi has to go from city to city. How do we know that if he doesn't run to another area, but stays in his own city, or he goes from neighborhood to neighborhood in his own city, that that works? That's the latter pasuk that's brought. Mikan Amru will be affected in tandem with how you read Mimkomcha, which is that if you believe it's just a generic or general statement about the fact that Machne Leviyah functions as a place of refuge, then it would be Mikan Amru, Pelach the Pelach. Ben Levi has to move to go to somewhere to get sanctuary, which is that if it's something like Makom, you have a place to go, Mimkomcha, from your place, meaning that your place will serve as a sanctuary, but you will also have a place to go from that place of sanctuary. On the other hand, if you read it like Rashi and Zvachim, that Mimkomcha means that the sanctuary will start from your place itself, or your mimkomcha, your place itself will act as a sanctuary. Means for you, it will act as a sanctuary. Then it will be actually telling us the other din, which is Mikan Amru, that if you stay in your own location, that provides you sanctuary. And that might be affected by how you read Bipelach the Pelach. Rashi leads me Pelach the Pelach Midina Midina. That means Mipelach the Pelach means from district or regional area to another regional area, or in essence means from city to city. Whereas Tosfos views Mipelach the Pelach means within a neighborhood, within the city, from neighborhood to neighborhood. And again, that might relate to how you read the previous Braita, as to whether it's teaching you Mipelach the Pelach, it's teaching you from ear to ear, or is it teaching you about Pelach the Pelach, which means from neighborhood to neighborhood. And even if he stays in Palcho, even if he stays in his own neighborhood, it will be Koleitim, as opposed to maybe Rashi, who would read it as he goes from city to city, but if he stays in his own city, then he'll have a right to stay in that city. So depending on how you read the Braita before, that will have impact on what Pelach means, or maybe vice versa. What you think Pelach means impacts what you think the Braita is teaching you. So either it's teaching you the necessity for Ben Levi to move from city to city, or it's possibly teaching you that within the city, the Ben Levi has to move Shkuna to Shkuna, or the fact that he stays in his own neighborhood suffices, or if he stays in his own city, it suffices. Now, the question in the Rishonim is, what does that mean? If you have to go to another city, you must go. If you don't have to go, then you can go from neighbor to neighbor. Over here it says, you're supposed to go to another city, but if you don't, then if you go from neighborhood to neighborhood, you're fine. So is it good or is it not good? Tosafot over here says that you have two options, and it's just a matter of good advice. You can use either one of these. Better to run to another city, because then you'll have the full accessibility to the whole city, than to go to another neighborhood where you'll be locked into that neighborhood. So it's just a matter of advice. So the Tosfos and Vachim suggest that it's a difference between the Chatchila and Bidiyavad. The Chatchila, you should go to another city, but if you don't, that still doesn't take away the fact that you are in a city of sanctuary, and therefore if you move from Shkuna to Shkuna, then that will work, even though we don't prefer that. That's not the best way that we want you to do this. And others still suggest that the difference has to do with whether he's going the first time or he's already in there because he had killed. If he's going for the first time, we tell him go to another city. If he's already killed and captured in a city of sanctuary, then we tell him to move from neighborhood to neighborhood because of the same problem as Rashi notes in the Mishnah. He can't leave the city. And so the two cases are not in the same situation. They are telling you that in situations where you're already there for sanctuary, then you move from a neighborhood to neighborhood. Just finish off here with the next Mishnah, which is Kiyotzebo. Similarly, the problem with Kiyotzebo here is it has nothing to do with the previous Mishnah or previous Mishnayot. It's very hard to read Kiyotzebo. For that reason, people, you can see here on the side that it's taken out by some of the Mifashim, although the Mashal, the Tosfot Yom Tov, mentioned that in the context where this Mishnah is found, which is in Shvi'it, Kiyotzebo makes a lot of sense. And that is, Kiyotzebo Rotzeach Shigala Le'ir Miklato, he was sent away to a city of sanctuary or a city of refuge, he ran away. Ratu Anshei Ro L'Chabdo, the people of the city want to give him some sort of honor, whether it's an aliyah, whether they want to put him on the board, they want to do something that gives him honor. Yomar Lehem Rotzeach Ani, he tells them, I am a murderer, and therefore I'm really not entitled to such honor. Amrulo Afo Pikain, they respond to him, even so, we still want to bestow this honor on you. Yikabel man. Then he has a right to accept it. Sinemar, Bezed Dvar HaRotzeach. This is the word of the Rotzeach. Word of the Rotzeach means, you have to tell him once you're a murderer, once you disclosed it once, and you try to dissuade them, if they say Afo Pikain, then it works. This exact thing is what we saw back in Daf Gimel by Shmitat Ksafim. When a person comes, a loveh, a debtor comes back to pay the malveh for the loan that he took out, the Malva says to him that the Kfar Nimchal, Shemitah came, you don't have to pay it. If the Lova says, Afal Pi Kain, even so I want to repay the loan, then the Malva can accept, the creditor can accept the payment. How do you know you don't have to keep saying it? It says, Zed Dvar HaShemitah. This is the word of Shemitah. You have to tell him once that the loan is forgiven. If he wants to pay it anyway, then you can accept the payment. And that way, the word Kiyotzebo makes sense now, because it's similar to that case of Shemitah. Is this case of Eri Miklat, that you only have an obligation to dissuade the individual from doing what they're doing once. Malin ayus schar le-levim, divir Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda believes that the Ari Levim are owned by the Levim. The right to sanctuary there is offered, but not a God-given right. And therefore you have to rent from the Levim that own the property in the city. You don't have to pay rent because it's a command of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It says, God says you can go there and you can take refuge there. That also gives you rights to own the property. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, the Tosafot says you have to pay mas and arnona l'nevi'im. You have to pay taxes and levies to the city, as well as just function there like any other guest would in the city. You want to live, you got to rent. As opposed to Rabbi Meir, who believes that you have a right to be in the city. That right in the city exempts you from any taxes. It also gives you a right to build a house or have a house wherever you want, and nobody can charge you for that. After he is released from the Ir Miklat, he goes back to his previous position. Rabbi Meir means that he returns to his original status. After he's released from the Ir Miklat, there's still a residual mark from what he did, and therefore he's not allowed to return to acting or functioning in that previous position. Rashi says, like Nasi, Rosh Beit Av, there you don't go back to the former position that you had with the death of the Kohen Gadol. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Gemara on the top of Yud Gimel Amud Aleph.